Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi everyone, I hope you're well. Oh, I've got a lovely guest today that it's somebody I've just met a few weeks ago. We were sat next to each other at a dinner party. He's a fabulous actor, comedy actor, writer. He was a child actor, actually. I'll just try not to laugh too much because he does make me laugh because he does amazing impressions. It is the lovely Kevin Bishop. Kevin Bishop, hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Very good, thank you.
You're looking slightly suntanned. You've just come back from La La Land, haven't you?
Yeah, been in Los Angeles for a few weeks, and it was a bit weird because the strikes were still in place.
Oh, yeah.
And they finished the day before I left, which was annoying because I'd been there for 3 weeks and I'd extended as much as I could, and I couldn't extend any further because my children were starting to wonder if I was ever going to come home.
Oh, absolutely. But it's good that they're over, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it is good.
My last thing I checked, I mean, is it completely over? Are actors going back to work legally? And
as far as I know, it's, yeah, everyone's going back to work and things are moving again. You know, but there was a lot of money lost in the strike. You know, I think the film industry was losing about £40 million a week.
Oh my God.
Over £1 billion that they've lost in the strike so far.
But, you know, it's like, you know, all the people, you know, not only actors, but everyone. I mean, you know, when you think of all the people on a film and, you know, people have got kids and mortgages, and I mean, it just,
it's very difficult for
those
people. Yeah, because they go from job to job to job, yeah, to job, and they don't get paid as much. And so they need to keep that work,
yeah,
constant stream of work. And so it's been brutal for all the chippies and the,
yeah,
you know, the other people on the set.
I know. I was behind the strike and everything because it's brilliant. I mean, actually, the lady who's head of SAG is a dear friend, Fran Drescher, and she did an amazing job.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Her speeches were amazing.
Yeah, incredible. I saw some.
I actually texted her and said, is it president next? She'd be a brilliant president.
Yeah.
So did you just go out there to see friends and just check in, or?
I haven't been to Los Angeles for around 5 years. And I used to live in Los Angeles. So it was nice to get out there. And actually, because of the strikes, all my friends were available. Nobody was working. So it was quite a nice social time. And the offices were still kind of open, but they were running at sort of, you know, half mast.
Yeah.
And yeah, so it was an odd trip, but it was good to get over there again
and reconnect.
And, yeah, reconnect with everybody. Yeah,
it is actually. We've got loads of friends because I've lived there in my life on two occasions. In the early 70s, I lived there for about 6 years, and in the 90s,
yeah,
we lived there. You know, Lee and I did because we were working. But you did a series there, didn't you, with Rebel Wilson? Am I correct?
That's right. Yeah.
Is that when you lived there?
Yeah, I lived there with my family. I moved my entire family to Los Angeles and shipped my entire house to Los Angeles. and everybody was like, this series is going to run and run. You know, get your family over here, bring them over. You don't want to leave them in London, it's too cold. And I brought all my family over, and then they cancelled the series, on the first series. And I then shipped everybody back to the UK house as well. I know. Yeah, it was a classic actor story.
Yeah, Snap. I did the same. We did the same. I did a sitcom with Fran.
Right.
In the early 90s called Princesses. And they did the same. We bought a house. Our daughter came over. Lee's son sadly couldn't because he was in the middle of A-levels. But, you know, so we were going back and forth. And they said again, oh, you'll be here for 10 years and... And a year later, you know.
I remember it was that classic thing. Whenever you speak to an actor who's had an experience in Los Angeles where they've got a show or something, there's so many, I mean, I've just heard so many brilliant stories about the boom and bust nature of what we do. And the things that they made me do to get that job, you know, there was a studio audition, then there was a network audition, and then there was like another four auditions. And I remember we turned up to the read-through. And I turned up and I saw some of the people that had been in the audition. I was like, oh, yeah, this is great. We're doing this. You got the part. That's brilliant. I'm so glad you got the part. And everybody was a bit subdued. And I thought, why is everyone in such an odd mood? And then they said, okay, we're going to read episode one. And then we're going to take a bathroom break. And then we're going to come back and we're going to read episode two. And I was like, oh, right. Okay. So we read episode one, went for the toilet break, came back. And they said, okay, so page one. Episode two, and I said, "Wait, hang on, Dave's not back from the toilet yet. He's." They said, "Oh no, Dave is. He's not with us anymore. We've had to let Dave go." And I realized that the read through, which normally for actors is like the bit, you know, it's a real moment of relief and excitement. It was actually the last audition. And it was like a murder mystery weekend, and then we'd do another episode and someone else would disappear. Musical actors.
Oh God, it's awful.
Awful. I remember there's that, when you're a Brit, you've got this thing that you're sort of natural sort of resting pessimism that you bring with you from the UK.
That's
and I remember
true.
We had our first viewing and then the reviews came out. It'd been on telly and it was a big, big show. It had a huge push. And I remember I read a review in the New York Times and I said, did anybody read that review in the New York Times? It said it was 3 stars. It was and they were like, nope, nobody read that. Nobody read that review. And I was like, really? That's the New York Times. In some places it's pretty damning. I said, if you were in the UK and you were doing a play, you'd be, no. And they were like, no, I don't think that the New York Times is really our demographic. And people physically moved away from me because I was being negative. But I was just saying, I just make a conversation. We're quite used to this. You know, if you're in a play or something and,
I know.
You know, it's the same every time for actors. It's always just like, what were the viewing figures? What are there enough bums on seats? And so it was a real experience working in Los Angeles. I felt like I was working for the mafia. It would be like, you know, I'd think like, now they're going to kill me. Today they're going to kill me. Oh, they're going to kill me now. We go into a room. We go, oh, they're going to kill me now. It was a bit like that. I never felt safe. I remember right at the end, this guy came up to me and he was the line producer. And then he said, hey, Calvin. He went, it's great to see you here on the lot. I went, oh, thank you. Yeah, he went, I saw your family and your children, and that's great to have you here in L.A. And I was like, oh, thank you. Well, it's lovely to be here. He went, and you're testing great. And I'd been there for like 8 months. And I was like, what do you mean? What, you're still testing me? He went, oh, yeah. They come into a room in Glendale and they if they like your shoes, they turn it up. If they don't, they turn it down. And it's okay. You're good. You're good.
I know. It's terrifying.
Scary.
Lee had an old friend. This is theatre, actually. But he came over from England and they'd done the play in London. I think it was a Joe Orton play. This is years ago. And they did opening night. And, you know, on Broadway, you go to Sardi's on opening night, which is a restaurant for, you know, drinks after the opening night show. And the producers wait, when in those days, they waited for the New York Times mainly to come out.
Yeah.
And Lee's friend said the actors were all like having a glass of champagne and toasting, saying, oh, this is great. The reviews came out and they were really bad. And they immediately came and closed the bar, took the champagne glasses out of the actors' hands, and they all had a return flight to London the next day.
Oh, I mean...
Isn't that horrible?
horrible.
Like nobody realizes what actors go through. They think it's just, you know, but it really is like it's literally like saying, well, how do you make your living? Well, I work in a casino and that's how I make my money. I gamble. You know, that's pretty much what it's like. And those stories, I've got so many of those stories from actors that I've known over the years. I remember one actor, I won't say his name, but he told me that exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
Him and his family, they all went to Los Angeles. They said, you got to take the kids out of school. Take the kids out of the school that they're in. You will never look back. It's come to Los Angeles. And he said, and when they got in the limousine, him and his family were so excited. They were putting the poster up. They were putting the huge billboard posters up on the road where he was driving. They were like, oh, look, he's on the billboard, look. And he said, they came onto the set one day and they said, the viewing figures are really bad. We're cutting the show. And they pulled the plug on the entire thing. And they sent them home. And he said, as he was going back in the limousine with his family, they were taking the billboards down. Cool. He'd only been there like a couple of weeks.
Oh,
it's brutal.
I mean, really we're laughing, but stories like that are horrible, aren't they?
Well, you put your whole life into the hope that it's gonna work out. And sometimes, for you know, you hear stories where it's been a huge success story,
yeah.
and it's a brilliant tale of success. But with America, they make so many pilots. They throw money at so much stuff in its initial phase that to a Brit, we think, well, hang on, the money they're spending, it must be,
I know, they must,
this is a goer, right? Yeah, you know, yeah. And it isn't.
I know, it's absolutely terrible. But that series with Rebel Wilson, am I right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that must have been amazing. Was she big when you did it? I mean, was she already famous?
She was. I mean, so I'd made a film with Rebel.
I love her, actually. I think
she's very, very funny. She's very funny. And I'd made a movie with her and Olivia Newton-John and Chris Marshall and Xavier Samuels. Yeah, we'd made a film in Australia a few years before. And I remember when we made the movie with Rebel, she'd just been in a Bridesmaids, Judd Apatow movie, but it hadn't been released. And so we were all on set and Rebel kept saying, hey, you know, guys, I've done this really big movie. It's a Judd Apatow movie. And we were like, oh, that sounds really good. And when it came out, it was just huge.
Huge.
It was absolutely huge. And Rebel really popped in that movie. So when we got round to, we made two pilots. One was the final pilot was for ABC. We did two versions as well. We did a live studio audience record, which was brilliant. But they didn't want that format. They wanted a single camera sort of show. And so we went on to do another version with ABC. And I think Rebel had just hosted the MTV Awards and they were something like 70% up on their demographic. And that was what led the show to be commissioned, was because Rebel was just such a huge instant star.
How brilliant.
Yeah,
it was a
really fun job. It was a brilliant, and it was Lauren Ash as well, who's in Superstore. She's gone to do Superstore now. But yeah, it was a brilliant cast, great fun.
I'm going to take you back to what you were born in London?
I was born in Farnborough Hospital in Bromley.
Oh, Farnborough Hospital is in Bromley, not Farnborough.
It must be. It's a different Farnborough. We do that in England, don't we? We give the same name to multiple places just to confuse everybody.
Just to confuse, yeah.
No, it was Farnborough Hospital in Bromley.
Bromley is London, isn't it? Or is it?
It's the London borough of Bromley. It's always a nightmare because if you say you're from London, people say, you're not, you're from Kent. And if you say you're from Kent, they say you're from London.
Isn't it one of those places that used to be in Kent and then they changed the border lines or something? Or has it always been London?
It used to be in Kent and then nobody in Kent wanted it anymore and they spat it out back into London again. They said, you have it. We don't want it. I mean, I've always looked at it as though it's South London. I mean, I love going to my parents still have the same house that I was born in.
Lovely.
And they're still there. And I love going to their house because it's 16 minutes to London Bridge. So I always think that classifies it as London, really.
I say, it's amazing. If you're a commuter, that is amazing, isn't it?
It's brilliant. So, I'm glad I'm not a commuter.
But it is brilliant. Yeah. So did that's where you grew up and went to school and everything?
That is where I grew up. Yeah, I mean, I didn't stick around for long. I went to, as soon as I could leave home, I moved to Brighton. I remember I went to Brighton with some friends, and I remember seeing the Fat Boy Slim concert on the beach in Brighton where it broke records of, and I thought that's where I want to live. And so I moved to Brighton, and I lived there for 20 years.
So how old were you then when you moved?
When I left home properly, I think I was about 20 years old.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I've been working as an actor since I was 10, professionally.
So how did you go to a kind of theatre group or a drama school or...?
Well, my mum was really into English and English literature, like when we were kids, and she put us in a drama club to help us with our English. I think that was her thought process. And she thought, well, if they're studying verse and prose and whatever, this will be really good for their understanding of English, because she was such an English nut. And then she put us in this drama club for fun, and I think it was a terrible mistake, because I became a very
hooked.
Precocious child, yeah. And I was like, right, we've done this drama club bit. When are the films coming? When are we doing the films? When are we doing the plays and the musicals? She's like, well, hang on. And that was it. It actually ended up being terrible for my education as opposed to helping it, because I just didn't want to go to school.
So was it like once a week after school?
Yeah, it was usually at the weekends.
Oh, okay.
So we did tap classes, modern classes.
Oh, can you tap dance?
Yeah, that's how it all started. My
it's
first
great.
Professional job was Churchill Theatre pantomime with Lionel Blair as a tap dancer for Lionel Blair.
Wow.
That was my first professional job.
You must be good.
Well, I wasn't very good, but we became good with Lionel because he was a perfectionist.
Yeah.
And so the tap routines and the dance routines were absolutely brilliant, you know, and we were under a huge pressure to get those right, because if Lionel saw that you weren't doing it properly, he
brought out the whip.
Yeah. He was really old school.
But it's so lovely to me, especially younger people like you who are still tap dancing, because I think it's the best form of dance. It's so... I mean, I learned for the first film I did, and I didn't do it as a kid.
Mm.
So I suddenly, at age 18, was thrown into tap class because I had to learn it.
Well,
but
it
I loved
those...
it because it makes you feel like Fred Astaire, who's my
yeah.
hero.
Yeah. Well, my tap dancing was more like Freddy Krueger, but I mean... the good thing about tap dancing is that, especially when you're sort of you're a kid, it develops your muscles and your balance. So, like, I didn't realise how much of an impact it had on my football and rugby and tennis and all these other sports that I played. The tap dancing was a good thing to have started with.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
Do you still tap?
not if I can help it. Sometimes people will say to me, you know, give us a little bit or whatever. And it's been such a long time since I did it. I mean, it's got to be, 30 years since the last sort of tap job. Yeah.
So how old were you when you did that panto?
I was 8.
Oh, you were little.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
So did you have to miss school and things?
Yes. Well, not so much for that pantomime, but yeah, there was... I mean, when you're a child actor, you get an allotted amount of days. I think up until the age of 12 or something, you get 40.
Oh, that's why they have lots of different kids playing the same role, right?
That's it. And so I remember my first big sort of London show was The Sound of Music, and it was an open audition. And I walked into... Because I badgered my parents to find me an agent, and they got the yellow pages and opened the book, and they found Sylvia Young's acting school for gifted children or whatever, and they said, well, you've got to go to meet Sylvia Young. And we didn't know who Sylvia Young was. You know, my parents aren't in the industry at all. I've got no one really, you know, to assist. And so my parents walked me into Sylvia Young's, and she was sat in the corner, and she said, can you sing, darling? I said, yes, I can. She went, sing Happy Birthday. I went, Happy Birthday. She went, you're in. You've got an open audition next week. It's Sadler's Wells. And so I had to go to Sadler's Wells Theatre. And I remember there were 2,000 kids there.
Oh, my goodness.
It was an open audition. And then they whittled it down. And then one day I was just sat on the floor with a load of other kids and this microphone comes through and they said, how does it feel to be Kurt in The Sound of Music? And I just looked at the, I said, have I got the part? And that was on Newsround. And that was my first really big professional show. And then within like a couple of weeks, we were singing for the Queen. And then I never stopped. I just didn't stop working from that point as a kid. I worked nonstop as a child. And yeah, didn't experience the hardships of acting until I was older.
So that change from being a child actor to being an adult actor, was that, you know,
very
you
difficult.
Often read stories, you hear stories, especially from Hollywood. Hollywood's child stars often didn't manage.
Yeah, I think making that transition is very, very difficult. And I was lucky in the sense that I had two lives, really, because when I got to the age of around sort of 17, 18, where I wasn't a boy and I wasn't a man. And also I looked very, very young when I was about 18. I probably looked about 15. And so that transitional period was very, very difficult, as it is for a lot of child actors who become, especially if they've had a lot of success when they were younger. You know, I'd made a film with the Muppets and I'd had quite a lot of fame as a young teenager. So suddenly saying to people, well, I'm now a male, sort of adult male actor, and I'm ready to do work. That was a difficult transition, and it took a few years and a few normal jobs until I'd you know,
managed
to get back in.
It shouldn't be, though. If you're good through your childhood and your teens, it should be a natural progression. But maybe it's the people who do the casting, they still see you as a kid. I've never really understood why.
I think it's a different time now. I think that this is, I think, you know, if a child had the success that I'd had when I was a kid, like if they had the equivalent now, they would be almost sort of valued as an asset, a bankable asset, and they manage them and they end up building their careers from there, a little bit like it was if they're a tennis star or a football. They put them in these academies, and that's, so it's much more business-like now than it was then. But back then, it was a much more transient industry, where it's like, oh, you were good then, and now we need someone else. So it was very difficult to break back in, and I actually came back in through comedy, because as soon as I did a few sort of heavy dramas, and then there, you know, things were quiet, and then these auditions came through, and they were for comedy, and as soon as I did those, I just got sidelined into comedy, and comedy just didn't let me go for a good sort of 10, 15 years.
And was that in TV? Was it stand-up? Was it?
No, I've never done stand-up.
You've never done stand-up?
No.
Oh, that's interesting.
No, it's because in those days, if you were to do stand-up, it would be detrimental to your acting career.
Oh, okay. So it was just comedy, TV, film?
Yeah.
Theatre?
Yeah. Yeah. Lots of theatre and lots of sort of. I had my own TV show when I was 26.
Oh my goodness!
I know, I was too young, and it was completely overwhelming. But we did it, and we did two series on Channel 4.
Yeah,
but it was,
I remember.
It was never how I thought it would go. It was never, and I've, any actor you talk to always says the same thing. It's never the trajectory that they thought they were going to have. It's always something different.
No. But don't you always say it's like, over the years, you know, when you're interviewed, they kind of say, well, how did you plan your career? I don't think you can plan your career.
No.
How can you plan your career?
No, absolutely not.
How do you
not.
Know? I mean, I didn't plan my career, certainly.
Yeah.
And most actors you talk to, a lot of the time it's luck of the draw of what you get. I mean, talent obviously has to be there. But I don't understand how they think you can plan your career. You know, well, next year I'm going to be doing this and next year I'm going to... Impossible.
I think it's all about those breaks and those opportunities and how they come to you. I mean, the breaks for me were always doing something that none of us had any idea if this would be any good or not. Those were the ones, you know. I mean, when I made the film with the Muppets, it was very clear that we were doing something that was going to be successful, and you know, we were like, well, this is, you know, this is a big film. But
big
with
film.
Star Stories was the thing that really broke me back into comedy in the UK, and
oh, okay.
We knew that it was We knew that it was funny because we were having a great time on set, but we had no idea that Star Stories was going to be as successful as it was and that it would launch, you know, careers in that way. We just had no idea. It was just something we were having a lot of fun doing.
But that's the great part of our business, that you most of the time you are doing I mean, occasionally you do ones you don't like, but
well, I think a lot of the time we have to do things we don't like. It's worrying now because there used to be things that we could do that would stop us from doing jobs that we weren't keen on, but the money was good. You know, yeah. And so we had things like voiceovers and whatever that we could sort of buffer that and be a bit more selective with the work. But it isn't like that anymore. It just isn't like that anymore.
Isn't it?
No, it's very difficult now. So you kind of, I feel that everyone's just trying to get out there in some way, whereas that wasn't advisable when I was growing up, which is why I didn't do commercials and I didn't do stand up and things like that, because it was frowned upon as an actor. I'm talking 30 years ago.
Yeah. Well, Lee, who's much older than you, my husband, he was an actor, a dramatic actor when he was, you know, well, he still is. But I mean, when he was doing big films in like the 70s, he was offered a commercial and he did it because, you know, it was a big commercial and it was good money. But lots of people said, oh, darling, you shouldn't do that, you know.
Yeah.
You're a dramatic act. You know, you've been at the RSC and the National. You can't do it. You know, it's absolutely mad, isn't
it?
I wonder if that
comes from how it used to be broken into sections. So with Equity, you used to have to have your theatre ribbon and on your TV ribbon and your film ribbon. So there were, so you could only be... So most actors were either a TV actor or a film actor or a theatre actor. It was difficult to get all of them. So if you, I don't know if that's why that is, but it's kind of, there was an element of snobbery involved when I was a young actor.
Yeah, but even further back that went on, because again, an actor who's no longer with us, he was quite, not very famous, but quite a big dramatic actor. You know, he'd done the National and he'd done Straight Plays, and then he did a really big comedy series that was a huge hit in this country, and he never got offered anything dramatic ever again.
Yeah.
And one day he was in a bar with somebody at the Beeb or something, and he said, you know, I don't understand it, you know, I never seem to get, you know, I've been in this comedy series, I'm on telly all the time. And they said, once you've crossed that line and gone into comedy, you won't get... But this is back in the 70s.
Yeah, but I think this...
So do you think
that's
changed?
I think it still stands. Yeah, I think it still stands.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because I used to get lots of... and it was interesting because when I have like parallel careers. So I used to make a lot of cinema in Europe as well.
Oh, and did you? That's...
Yeah, and they have no idea that I do comedy in the UK. They have absolutely no idea. They just see me as a sort of serious actor in sort of films. And that must
be lovely for you to have.
At the time,
it
was brilliant. It was brilliant because I got to travel all these lovely places in Europe for work, and it was brilliant. And they were always kind of, you know, low. There was small budget, but they weren't tiny budgets, and they just really looked after us, and we were very lucky. But they had no idea the comedy things that I were doing in the UK, and subsequently nobody in the UK knew about the European cinema stuff that I did one or two of these movies every year. Nobody knew about it. So it's in, but I think now everything you do, everyone knows about. But it was, I mean, I had this conversation with Steve Coogan. Steve said to me, he said he couldn't get away from comedy until he did Philomena. And then he was taken seriously as an actor, but he was literally, no one would say, no, they were just like, oh, he's an impressionist.
Brilliant.
So that's what I get.
Exactly.
As well.
I bet you do, because I know from sitting next to you at a lovely dinner party, you did do some amazing people. Well, it made me laugh anyway.
Well, you
were telling me you did. You did that show at the chocolate factory, the Menier chocolate factory, where you played how many characters?
It was 40 characters in 90 minutes.
Oh.
Yeah. I remember they sent me the play. I just got back from Los Angeles, actually, and I had my tail between my legs, and this script landed on the door, and they said, we want Kevin to be in this play. It's a one-man show and only Kevin can do it. And I started reading this script and I was like, this isn't a one-man show. There's all these people in it. I think they've sent me the wrong script. And they said, no, it's the right script. You're playing everyone. And I was like, oh, God. And I, honestly, in my head, I thought, what a terrible idea. I'd hate to see that play. I can't imagine anything worse than some bloke playing all these characters. This is awful. And we had no idea how successful it was going to be until, I mean, even in the sort of final sort of tech and dress runs, I mean, the producer was just sat there looking at his phone. I thought, this is going to be a disaster. No one's going to like this at all. And then we had five previews. And the only time it went without a hitch was press night, because when you're in a play on your own, so if you're in a normal play, you've got other actors there. They go, yes, Henry, and what about the fireplace with the candelabra? And they can pull you out of a
exactly.
If you dry, they can pull you out. Whereas this play was just me on the phones. The concept was this guy comes in work. He's rushing, he's late. When he arrives at work, which is like the equivalent of the Chiltern Firehouse or something in New York City, he arrives and none of his work colleagues have showed up for work that day. They've all called in sick. So he's on the phone and everyone's trying to get a table, all these, you know, self-important people. And I'm the person, I'm the character throughout, this guy who's this struggling kind of actor throughout, who, but when he answers, I'm the person on the other end of the phone as well. So
God. You
had to use your body physically to show that you were somebody else as well. But it was,
so there were no change of costume.
There was no change of costume.
Oh,
it was like
God.
Breakneck pace, 90 minutes, no interval all the way through.
Oh my God. I'm amazed you didn't have a nervous breakdown, or maybe you did.
Well, when you talk to other actors about drying on stage, I remember the first previews when I dried, I remember standing there and two women had come in and they were sort of like my mum's age, and they'd been to Marks and Spencer's and they had bottles of red wine and nibbles, and they were sitting there and she was going, oh, what have you got there? I'll have one of those. It's a very intimate space. And she was going, oh, lovely. No, I'm all right. I've had some of those. Can I have a glass of white, please? Thanks very much. All right, lovely. Yeah, just that's enough. Thanks very much. They were literally like this in the front row.
Oh,
and
God.
I dried at one point. And in your mind, you scan through the entire play in your head and so you know where you are. And the phone was just ringing. And I was thinking, who is that on the end of that phone? It's me, but who? And then it went on for too long. And one of these women just turned to the other woman. She went, oh, dear. And that was enough. I knew. And I would only liken that fear to sort of,
oh,
you know,
God.
You've woken up in the middle of the night and you can hear something walking around in the kitchen. It's there.
I did a play years. I did Blythe Spirit and I played the ghost, Elvira. And the guy playing Charles, the male lead, had lots of scenes with Madame Arcati, you know, the older woman, and the actress playing that part, and she would do all these magical things and seances. I won't say who it was, but she would dry terribly. She couldn't remember. But not only would she dry, but she'd jump pages.
Lethal.
So that poor Charles, he lost a stone in weight. Because he never knew where she was going. Every performance, he'd always get out of it, but he was a nervous wreck. It was all right for me because I was the ghost and nobody talked to the ghost except Charles. So it didn't affect me, but this poor guy playing Charles, I felt so sorry for him because there's nothing you can do.
There is nothing worse. And if you've got one of those actors with you that kind of says... That is up for the improv to get us out of it. They can make it worse because if nothing sounds familiar, then we don't hear a cue. It doesn't jog the memory. So it's a bit like when you listen to an album and you know when you're listening to a certain song what song's coming on next. So it's a bit like that when you've learnt your lines. So you think, I can hear this line, I know what's coming next. And so we always get, you always find if you're working with a good director, they always say to you, listen to what they're saying. And then you will remember your lines. And a lot of actors, sort of more selfish actors, they don't really listen to what the other person's saying. So they just know their lines. But yeah, it's nothing. There's absolutely, it's the worst worst fear ever, especially if it's a press night or something. It's horrendous.
Well, press nights are horrible anyway.
The other one is corpsing. The other one is laughing. I mean, I am actually, self-confessed, a terrible corpser. And if I'm working with an actor who is got a bit of a twinkle or someone who's naturally funny as well, I mean, there are a few actors that I actually can't work with. Because on TV or in theatre,
they make you laugh.
Well, because we make each other laugh. We've just got one of that. It's one of those things, and when I keep getting put in things with them, and I almost want to say to the producers, can you please just go and look at the outtakes of Star Stories, and then you'll never pair me up with Oliver Mortman ever again, because there's literally 110 takes where we cannot stop laughing. But
it's terrible because the more they tell you to stop laughing, the worse it gets. If you're filming and they say you mustn't laugh, I mean, that's the worst thing you can say. I'm a terrible giggler.
Yes.
And I once got it on stage when we were meant to be singing a duet. And the guy did his bit and then I was meant to come in. And by this time I'm crying with laughter and my shoulders are going up and down. And he knew that I couldn't sing. So he sang the whole song. And this was in a big Broadway show, but there was no way I could stop laughing. It was, and I held the laughter in. I didn't laugh out loud, but the tears and the shoulders, it was, and it's awful.
Well, the stakes just get higher the more it goes on. And so, and I always find whenever there's we get a fit of the giggles, it's always at 10 to 7. You know, when we've lost the light or we're losing the light and everybody's knackered and it's the last scene of the day and we're delirious. And I remember when we made the Kevin Bishop show, I worked with two actors, Oliver Mortman and Jim Howick, and I've known them for a long, long time. They're really good friends. And Oliver Mortman and I literally just can't be on set together. And because he's got this laugh where he keeps a straight face, but he goes... And so I laugh at his noise and I get the blame. And I say, well, he's laughing. He's been laughing for the last 10 minutes. He's just not moving his face. It's his fault. And it's the worst.
Like being back at school.
It's so bad. Yeah, it's so bad. And you really need... And when you can't get yourself together... I mean, I remember I was working with this actor once again. I won't name names. And he got a fit of the giggles. And he just had to walk off stage and just have a word with himself. It was a good sort of 5-6 minutes that we were sitting there waiting for him to come back because he'd just been corpsing on the stage.
But that's why, you know, when they do outtakes on telly, the best ones are newsreaders when they lose the plot.
Yeah,
They're the best. Yeah. And they do make you hysterical with laughter. And that must be awful, especially if you're doing a very serious piece of news.
Yeah.
Can you imagine? It must be...
The worst. And a sackable offence, I should imagine.
Now, you played Dudley Moore in something. Yeah, was it a stage play?
Yeah, it was Pete and Dud, Come Again. It was, we did a show in Edinburgh. Originally, it was Scott Handy and I. Here's Scott Handy playing Peter Cook. And then we got a transfer to the West End, and then it was Tom Goodman Hill playing Peter Cook, and it was such a brilliant experience. It was really great getting into the research for that because I always loved Dudley Moore, and I grew up watching Dudley Moore as a kid,
and so lovely.
I had no idea just how talented a person he was, and that he was a concert level pianist Dagenham, and it was fascinating. Sort of studying that.
He was a sweet... I only met him a few times, but he was such a lovely man.
Yeah.
Just a really... I mean, Peter Cook was great, but he was a bit odd. But Dudley was just lovely. He was just really nice, really sweet. So how long did you do it?
That run was 3 months in the West End. And when was that? I think it was 2005, I think, was when...
Yeah, I've got... I did my research, you see. 2005, you get
a
tick.
Yeah, good.
No, because it does all... When people say to me, what year did you do that? I can't remember. Mind you, I'm much older than you, but I can't remember because it does kind of, you know, vaguely the decade.
Yeah, I mean, it is. When I think, God, it's nearly it's nearly 20 years ago. It's quite scary, but yeah, it was such a fun thing to do, because, you know, we'd have a piano on stage, and so I had to study, you know, the songs that Dudley Moore played. I can't play the piano that well. I can't even read music. So we kind of staged it so it looked like I was playing the piano. And I had this wig to play Dudley Moore. And one night, the wig just came off, but was still attached to my head. And so I'd practiced it with all these sort of head movements as Dudley Moore. And the audience were in tears, laughing so much. So it was one of those shows that we would do when we would do Pete and Dud, when we would do the all right Pete, yeah, all right, we'd do the, you know, with the caps on. Most of the time we'd make each other laugh anyway. So, but it worked really well because they would often corpse.
I say all those clips you see, they would corpse, wouldn't they? Which is why
it was so funny. Yeah,
yeah,
funny. Yeah,
they'd start. The shoulders would start going. Absolutely.
But the people that came to that show because of the time of, you know, because we was all set around like an 80s chat show, like a Wogan-esque 80s chat show. Uh-huh. And it was incredible, the people that came to see it that were from that era and just had, you know, they remember them. They knew them personally. And when I was doing the research, several people reached out to me and said, I hear that you're playing Dudley Moore. I knew Dudley, and I'd love to talk to you about him. And I remember Barry Cryer, lovely Aww. Barry Cryer, the late Barry lovely. Cryer. He was very helpful, and he said to me, he said, I remember. He said, I remember meeting Dudley Moore on London Bridge, and he said, I've got an audition tomorrow in LA. He said to be in the movie 10. He said, and they're recasting it. I don't know why they want to see me. And he said, I knew I'd not see him for a long time. He said, he had that thing about him. And he says, and he was in the rain and he walked over the bridge and waved at Barry Cryer in the rain. And he said, he didn't see him for 10 years.
Wow.
And he was in a bar in London. He said, and his little hand came through with a half pint of lager and went, there you go, Barry, lager.
And, how brilliant.
So all those little stories are really helpful when you're trying to find a character and you don't Absolutely. All you have is interviews and stuff. It's good to find those moments of you know, those heartfelt moments, because they help you to attach emotion to what you're doing. You get a much more of an insight of who the person was.
Absolutely. I haven't asked you, but are you a tea drinker as we're having tea?
I am a tea drinker.
What's your poison?
I love English breakfast tea, Yorkshire tea. I don't drink milk so much anymore, but I'll have it if it's all anyone's got. But if I have Earl Grey, it's got to be black and not too strong. But builder's tea, no sugar. That's how I like it. Yeah.
Oh. Okay, quite strong.
Quite strong.
I'm on me. Do you do herbal? I'm on my lemon and ginger at the moment.
I do herbal teas if I'm ill, and that's it. I do lemon and ginger if I've got a cold, but that's it. I tell you what I have got onto recently is apple tea. So fresh what? Apple juice and then topped up with hot water. Really nice apple tea.
Oh.
Yeah.
So it's actually just apple juice with hot
just
water.
Just apple
in.
Juice with hot water. Oh. It's really nice.
Oh, that's interesting. I should try that.
But I in the mornings, I like coffee, strong coffee.
No, I'm not. I can't drink coffee. It gives me, it makes my heart palpitate.
Yeah, me too. That's why I do it. Yeah.
Now, I can't believe you played Nigel Farage.
Yes,
that's
did.
That's hysterical.
Yeah.
Did you meet him?
I didn't meet him. So the BBC, at the time, I was doing a lot of stuff with the BBC, and they said, Nigel Farage had just left UKIP, and they were saying, well, Nigel's left UKIP and we want to do a thing called, because he says in his resignation, he said, I want my country back and I want my life back. Right. So Nigel Farage, it's about his life. Now he's quit UKIP. Now he gets his life back. What does he do? And they sent me this script and they said, we want you to play Nigel Farage. I said, well, I don't really do Nigel Farage. I said, he's not someone that I don't really study impressions. I can either just do them or not. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, you've got to, because you're playing him. And I was like, well, all right. And I was really panicking because I couldn't get the voice. And then I watched his resignation for UKIP. He says, as of today, I'll be resigning as UKIP leader. I want my life back. Thank you very much. Goodbye. And then he walks off the stage and I noticed that he had this sort of headbutt whenever he was talking. And as soon as I get the physicality of the character, then the voice comes.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so with Nigel, it's always like that. That's how he speaks. And he's got this slight purr when he talks. And he obviously does. Smokes 40 Rothmans a day as well, which
does he? Oh,
which
my
helps.
Goodness.
Yeah.
Oh.
I actually started smoking for that role to get the voice right, and I found it really hard to quit, and I still find it difficult.
I bet.
I'd been the odd fag
casual
here and there when I was
yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, but never properly. But doing that role pushed my nicotine consumption into
oh
new levels.
Oh, my God. And then you had to quit.
Then I had to quit, yeah.
Oh, God, that's...
Yeah,
awful.
Very difficult. Thanks, Nige. Thanks for that. but I remember before it came out on TV, he wanted to meet me and take me for a proper lunch. we'll have a chat, we'll meet each other. And I avoided it completely, but I think he just wanted to find out what we'd said about him.
Oh, yeah.
But it was,
yeah,
you
I
know...
Bet.
I all my characters that I play, I always like to sort of have a... I don't like to... They have to be funny and they have to be likeable in some way. That's how I like to do them.
Well, he's quite a character, isn't he?
Yes.
We went to a dinner party once and he was my, you know, my dinner partner.
Right.
And I thought, oh, my... And actually, when we sat down, I just said, I don't talk politics, so please don't let's do that. And actually, he was fine. We got on fine.
I should imagine he was probably relieved that you didn't want to talk politics, you know?
Oh, God.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to get into politics with him.
No.
Now, tell me about this. I know we've got to go soon. We've been going too long, but I could chat for ages. But about this, you're doing the voice for the virtual band Gorillaz.
So they have an animation story that's as old as the band itself. That's, I think it was, you know, the whole thing came about because... I think this is why, because Damon didn't want to do press. He was so fed up with doing press from Blur.
Yeah.
He said,
yeah,
is there anything we can do where we just have, it's all about the music and nothing else? And so they created this animation. So there's this virtual band and the music is with the band and it's myself and Phil Cornwell.
Mm-hmm.
And he plays Murdoch and I play 2D. And then we've got Remy Kabakba, who was a percussionist for Gorillaz, who plays Russell Hobbs. And then we've got Noodles, the guitarist. And most of the... Yeah.
Oh, and my producer's
this
holding
is
up.
It. This is it. And
He's got it.
And I'm 2D, who is the lead singer. So when he sings, it's Damon. And when he speaks, it's me.
It's you.
Yeah.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
So now you've got kids. I know you have. How many have you got?
I've got two children, two girls.
Oh.
They're becoming teenagers. So I've got a 14-year-old and a 12-year-old.
Oh.
And yeah, so it's new territory at the moment. More expensive territory and much more explosive territory, I've noticed as well. Trying to get them off their phone, it's a little bit like, you know, wrenching sort of drugs from a drug addict. But
I know.
Yeah, they've been really we've got a very close bond, my girls and I. And
good.
Yeah, they're good fun. It's good hanging out with them. They're much funnier than me.
I can't believe that. But
they really are.
Listen, it's been so lovely chatting to you.
You
I
too,
could chat
Twiggy.
For ages. Well, we'll have to meet up at some point
soon. Yeah, I would love that.
And carry on our conversation.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Twiggy.
And we'll see you soon. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, that was so much fun. And I tried not to make too much noise laughing. I hope I didn't make too much noise. Anyway, he's a really lovely chap, is Kevin. And I hope you enjoyed our discussion as much as I did. Anyway, stay well and I'll see you soon. Bye. If this is your first time listening to Tea with Twiggy, please do remember to tell your friends. You can also subscribe for free on your podcast app and listen to all my previous guests. If you want to connect with me, I'd love to hear from you. You can find me on Twitter at Twiggy, or you can find me on Instagram at Twiggy Lawson. My thanks go to all the people that have helped this podcast happen. Many thanks to James Carroll and all the team at North Bank Talent Management. Thanks to all the team at Stripped Media, including Ben Williams, who edits the show, my producer Kobe Omanaka, and executive producers Tom Wally and Dave Corkery. The music you can hear now is my version of Waterloo Sunset by The Kinks. If you'd like to hear the whole song, you can find it and all the other songs I've recorded on iTunes and Spotify, so check it out. I look forward to you joining me for my next episode. So see you then. Bye.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.